Actually, also as one more word of introduction is that it's just very apropos. Today's daf in Daf Yomi is Sota Daf Mem Vav. And on Mem Vav on the days, so one of the discussions the Gemara has is the proper etiquette one is supposed to engage in when taking leave of a friend. That the Gemara mentions that when someone takes leave of another person, so they should take leave with a Dvar Halacha. That they should share words of Torah, they should share words of Halacha as they take leave of one another, to indicate in different ways, different ideas have been shared on that topic. But the one I would want to share today is that when one leaves through words of Torah, so then that's one way of indicating that the relationship does not end, but is going to continue. Because words of Torah are words that continue, are part of a Rava. They continue to generate, they continue to flourish, and through the conversation, through taking leave of one another through Divrei Torah, so then that is an opportunity for the relationship to continue. And the relationship that have been started here over this past Shabbos have really been incredibly wonderful, incredibly enjoyable, and it should just be the beginning of opportunities to connect, opportunities to learn together and grow together. My email address is available at the end of these slides, and definitely would love to have all of these conversations from that we began over Shabbos to continue. So please don't be strangers if you ever end up in Washington Heights. Number one, I'm sorry. Number two. Please don't be strangers. Please reach out. Would love to see you and reconnect. Today's topic: historical dissection, halachas, integration of medical sciences through the ages by Do Fink. That's me. And that actually, I don't know if you could tell. That's a picture of my chavrus and I. That's Rabbi Packer. Shlita is the Sholem Yeshiv at Yeshiva University. He is an incredibly big Torah scholar, and is available in Hawaii based Medrash for people to come over and ask him questions on anything they want. So he is pretty much available to answer a question on anything in Torah that you could imagine, and he is very qualified to do so. It's really, really impressive and a big, wonderful opportunity to learn with him. And right next to him is a Rembrandt. So we'll talk about the Rembrandt as we get further in the presentation. What areas of halacha are impacted by medicine? So let's hear from the crowd. What do we think? Shabbos, very good. What about Shabbos? Very good. Meaning pushing off Shabbos.
We push off Shabbos
to save a life. Very good. What else? What else comes up? What other areas of halacha are impacted by medicine? Free association. What comes to mind? Medicine, halacha, pretty much anything.
It's most in general, whether or not one can't fulfill it, you got to make it up.
If one can't fulfill it, you're saying because of a medical condition, you're not able to perform a certain mitzvah. Okay, very good. Anything else?
Abortion.
Great. Come on. Give all the topics. I mean, the hot button issues. What are the hot button issues? Anything? Nothing? All right, I put a few things here on the list. A couple of things. This is very much a very incomplete list, and something I made when I couldn't sleep at 1:30 in the morning. So it's certainly incomplete and just a random list. So fasting on Yom Kippur, end-of-life issues, fertility, hilchos nida, pandemics, alternative medicine, circumcision, mitzitza bepeh, pikuach nefesh on Shabbos, some of these things we mentioned, and a lot more. And of course, with Kabbalah Satorah, as, I don't know if you can read it, but as the Kaddish Baruch Hu told Moshe, take two tablets and call me in the morning, is obviously an area of halacha, of medicine, impacted by halacha. For today's discussion, we will focus on the highlighted issues, fasting on Yom Kippur, fertility and circumcision, / mitzitza bepeh, all of those we will go into in detail as we go along. The Wikipedia page of definition of a posek is here on the board. I will not read it, but the definition of a medical doctor, as per Wikipedia, is also on the board. You may or may not notice that neither of those is me. I'm not a posek. I'm not a decider of halachic law. I am also not a medical doctor. Therefore, I am incredibly disqualified to be giving this presentation. Nevertheless, it's a topic that I fell into, a topic that I gained a lot of interest in and passion about, and came across a few very cool resources. One of the major ones that really is the backbone of this discussion, pun intended because of the cover, is Rabbi Dr. Eddie Reichman, who is also received smicha from Yeshiva University, and is a medical doctor. He teaches at Einstein and is an emergency doctor somewhere in the New York area. And he just recently published in 2021 this big book called The Anatomy of Jewish Law, which was more or less the inspiration of the title of today's presentation. But in any case, if you have similar sentiments to the one that the individual up here on the board has when he is interacting with the his provider, so I don't blame you. But nevertheless, we'll get into the discussion and talk about reproductive medicine, fasting on Yom Kippur, and the third will be Mitzitza B'Peh. That's a picture over there of my son's bris earlier this year. He's now 8 months and very cute. The halachic history of reproductive science says Mazel Tov, it's a boy or it's a girl. We will begin just a couple weeks ago in Parshas Tazria. So the Tazria opens by Adaber al Bnei Yisrael, Isha ki Tazria. Speak to the Jewish people, Isha ki Tazria, a woman when she conceives, we'll translate that as that for now, V'yalda Zachar, and she gives birth to a boy, V'tama Shivas Yamim, she will be impure for 7 days, Kimei Nidas Devosa Titma, similar to the way that if she has a blood flow, so then that will make her ritually impure as well. So that's the and then the rest of that discussion over there on the Pesukim is primarily focused on the ritual impurity that results from childbirth. However, the Gemara in Nidon, Daf Chaf Hei Amabiz, here on the board, has a fascinating drasha, extrapolates from the Pasuk the following, V'amar Rav Yitzchak Bar Ami, Isha Mazra'as Tchila, based on these words, Isha Ki Sazria, when the woman will now translate as give seed, Mazra'as Tchila, Yoledas Zachar, she will bore a boy, Ish Mazria Tchila, if the man provides the seed first, Yoledas Nekeva, then the child that is born will be a girl. Now, based on our contemporary understanding of the way that human reproduction works, and for those who recently took ninth grade biology will probably be more familiar with this, but in any case, this is that does not necessarily resonate with contemporary medical understandings of the way that the gender of a child is determined based on what does that even mean is a little bit ambiguous and unclear. What does it mean to be Mazra'as Tchila? What does it mean for an Isha to be Mazra'as, to provide the seed? What does that even mean? How do we understand that? Again, this is in the Gemara. This is going back to many generations ago. In fact, the Gemara needs a few daf later on Lamed Aleph and Aleph tells us Shlosha Shutfim Yesh Ba'Adam, a somewhat well-known line that there are three partners that go into the creation of a human being, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, V'Av V'Imo, Hashem, the father and the mother. And then the Gemara actually continues, of Mazria Haluban, and describes different components of the physiological makeup of a child that are provided by the father, that which is provided by the mother, and then HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Nosim Bo Ruach Hu Nesham of Klas Terpanim, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu breathes into the child Ruach Chaim, gives him a neshama, a soul, the animating life force that comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that is the Gemara over there. So now we have, any philosophers in the room? What? Nothing? No philosophers. Okay. So we're going to talk now, give a little bit of a background, and talk a little bit about history and the development of the medical field. And then as we talk about the development of the medical field, that will give us more of a framework to then dive in to the rabbinic sources and see the way that the rabbinic sources developed an understanding of this line that we started off with, of Isha Mazra'as Tchila, Yoled Zachar, that somehow that's going to impact or affect the gender of the child. Here on the board we have a artistic depiction of Aristotle and Galen. Photography from that time was awful, and it was non-existent. So artistic depictions of the two of them. These are both Greek philosophers and also medical physicians of the time. Back in those days, the fields of philosophy and medical science and science in general were not so well-defined, meaning they had not formed into distinct, specific areas of study. But if you were smart, you would philosophize, and you would also do science and suggest various theories for different scientific and medical realities. So both Aristotle and Galen, who we'll get to, had theories about the about conception. Conception was a hotly debated issue during that time. And as we'll see different ways of how that was incorporated into different rabbinic texts. So now with the history of anatomy in specific, how did the scientific field come to understand the workings of the human body? And for this, we talk about a few of my favorite things, which is Rembrandt and Padua. Two very different things, okay? Let's start with Rembrandt. Rembrandt's painting, this is on the title page as well, painting The Anatomy Lesson of Professor Nicholas Tulp in 1632. just a couple, few years earlier, in 1632, we have Andreas Vesalius, I apologize if I'm mispronouncing his name, who lives, the years there are 1514 through 1564, and he is the first physician and medical scientist to actually look at the human body and take a real-life human body, dissect it, and use that both for medical research and science and also for instruction. Dr. Tulp was another such individual a couple years later, as this started to become a method through which people have the are now going to be looking for an understanding of the human body. And Rembrandt made a painting depicting Dr. Tulp's anatomy lesson. We actually, there are a lot of cool things about this painting. I'm not going to go into all of them. If anyone here likes art, this painting actually has a lot of signature Rembrandt features that are very cool from an art historian or art critic's perspective, including Rembrandt's use of geometry, including his depiction of emotion, including the specific moment of an action that is being captured. All of those are uniquely Rembrandt features that are unique to the Golden Dutch Age, which is when he lived and when he was drawing his art. And he also drew scenes that were he had a wide range of scenes that he drew. This is what would be a contemporary cutting-edge technology that he was portraying to the world. We know the identity of all of the people who are in this painting. I can't say who they were myself. They were all well-known physicians and doctors and noblemen of the time. They actually had to pay to be painted in this portrait. Why? What did you say? Rembrandt needed an income. Rembrandt didn't need an income. This is true. Artists are not known for making a lot of money. Rembrandt didn't need an income. That's not necessarily why. I mean, that could be a very good reason why. But this was a way. Rembrandt was already one of the, I mean, there were a few of them, but at least one artist who already attained significant stature and reputation even in his own lifetime. So his paintings were very popular. If you were portrayed engaged in cutting-edge technology and medical research at that time, so you automatically gained stature and reputation in the medical field. So the doctors who were in this field were already relatively accomplished, but this was a way of advertising the fact that they were on the cutting edge of technology, they were well-versed in the most up-to-date contemporary medical science and research, so they were paid commission to be in this painting because this was cutting edge. The Anatomical Theater in Padua, which is the top, which is where Andreas Vesalius taught and did his research and medical instruction, happened at the University of Padua. It is, I believe, the only, if not one of the only, anatomical theaters that is still in existence. What's an anatomical theater? It's a place where noblemen, medical students, and other people come to view everyone's favorite form of entertainment, a human dissection. Wonderful. But what, again, similar reason for this is that at the time, that was a sign of your advancement in scholarship, your relationship with the cutting-edge technologies of the time, and that is why people would pay, both medical students for their own learning, but other people as well, would pay to come and witness an anatomical dissection and be able to learn a little bit more about the human body. The reason this is so important, and I'm spending so much time on this, is because I like it, but also because this is in 1632, you know, Versailles lives from 1514 to 1564, so relatively earlier than this, but again, still historically a new phenomenon. And prior to this point in the medical sciences history, everything we knew about the human body more or less was speculative or based on external observation or comparison to some form of animal. So we really didn't know so much about what was happening in the human body by looking at it with our own eyes until this time in history. So, as you can imagine, since that didn't happen, some mistakes may or may not have happened, some misconceptions could have occurred, and as is so in the depiction on the screen, something along the lines of have a seat, Kermit. What I'm about to tell you might come as a big shock when Kermit the Frog goes for his x-ray and is shocked to discover what's going on. In any case, back to the history of embryology. The history of embryology develops, as we mentioned, we have Galen and Hippocrates. We didn't mention Hippocrates, but again, another philosopher, physician from antiquity, together with Aristotle. So they all propose various theories as to how embryology, which is the study of the development of the fetus and the childbirth, develops. Galen and Hippocrates both posit that there is both male and female seed that is significant and contributes towards the development of a child. Aristotle disagrees and says that only male seed is significant and responsible for the development of a child. He says that there is the blood from the woman's body does contribute to the development of the child in Aristotle's mind. Then a bunch of years later, those theories are more or less debated, speculated, and gone back and forth throughout a few hundred years until we get to William Harvey, who is living from 1578 to 1654, and he suggests that living things all come from eggs, which is sort of more or less relatively accurate. René de Graaf in 1672 first describes the human egg follicle, and then Carl Ernst von Baer in 1827 publishes his description of the mammalian ovum. That happens again in 1827, which is historically relatively recently that we actually get a pretty accurate depiction of how the mammalian ovum actually looks, how it functions. Fascinating conversation I had last night about the how little we still know about the placenta. So there are a lot of things that are still unknown in the general broader field of embryology, but at least this is a process that is continuing to develop. We're continuing to learn more. Again, artistic depictions of the figures we just mentioned. Now let's get into rabbinic sources. We have the Ramban. Nachmanides, who was also actually a physician, which we do not know from anything that he writes, unlike the Rambam, who we'll mention. The Rambam was known to be a doctor, and he actually writes that in some of his letters and some of his writings, that he reflects on the fact that he is a doctor to the king, and his responsibilities are very great, and he doesn't have so much time to write. Somehow he wrote some of the most important rabbinic texts that we have in our rabbinic texts. But the Ramban also was a doctor, but he doesn't write about it himself. It is quoted in secular medical historical sources. And one of the issues he's actually quoted on is that he successfully treated a case of infertility. So just a fascinating, ominous discussion. The Ramban, on that parsha, where it says, Isha ki sazria, again, just a few weeks ago that we learned this, he says like this, V'ein kavanasam shi'asa havla mizara isha, that he quotes the Gemara we started with of how isha mazras tchila yoled zachar, that if a woman gives birth first, so the child that is produced will be a zachar. Says, V'ein kavanasam shi'asa havla mizara isha. This does not mean that the vlad comes from any zera from the isha, ki ha isha fal pi sheyesh la beitzim kebeitzei hazachar, even though there are anatomically, the Ramban seemed to be aware, as others were as well, that there were something similar to the beitzei hazachar that the isha has as well, the woman has as well. Shelo yasa b'hen zera klal, the Ramban says perhaps those do not produce any seed. O she'ein hazera hu nikba v'lo osa davar b'ubar, or that zera does not coagulate or something, or you become anything, make any contribution to the uber. Abul Amra Mazras, when they say Mazras, that she gives the seed, what's that referring to? Al Dam Harechem Shiasase Bishaska Marabia. It refers to the blood in the womb that will gather together when the couple's together. Be'im Umis Achis Bezerah Zachar, and then will grab onto the Zerah Zachar. He says, why? According to their understanding is he's referring to Chazal, the Gemara. They understood that a Vlad is created from the dam of the Nekeva, the blood from the mother, and from the white from the man. Ulishneam Yikru Zara. And when you combine the two of them together, that is what refers to as the seed. That may sound familiar from Aristotle's theory of conception. So the Ramban concludes over here in the bolded, V'gam das ha-rofim b'yetzira kachi. This is the understanding of the rofim. And then he quotes V'al das philosophim ha-yavanim. He quotes from the Greek philosophers, the ones that we mentioned before, and not in the same exact way, but this is where he goes into another element, a more philosophical element that was popular in the philosophies of the Greeks, of the fact that there's something called hiuli. Anyone here familiar with hiuli? Hiuli was the Greek understanding of the all-purposeful life source, something along those lines. So then he goes through some philosophical understanding of the way that conception works and the fact that the Zohar has hiuli and puts hiuli into the... Again, I'm sure I really comprehend what he's referring to in that statement, but just fascinating to note the fact that he's quoting from doctors and also quoting from philosophers to try to come to some understanding of the way that that conception works and what Chazal might be referring to when they are talking about it. Ibn Ezra, a few years earlier than the Ramban, has another posits another understanding. And all the pictures of Mother Earth is the Mother Earth model. V'hine appears Tazria titin zera kihi k'ma aretz. He actually compares the way the conception happens. That phrase, Mother Earth, is because of this. Is that kihi k'ma aretz? In some way, the same way the ground fosters and develops the growth of a plant and of something that will grow. So too, the mother will be the one that fosters the growth of the child. Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar says something very interesting. He says the isha becomes the holder of a pikadon. A pikadon is a collateral. That a collateral gives something, an important item to hold and to safeguard and to safekeep, and then that will be returned later. He says the same way that happens in conception, that the father of the child gives over some important element that is held and developed by the mother, and then the mother will give it back. The Rambam describes over here, we're not going to read through it, but describes in pretty close detail to the way that we are familiar with today, the physiology of conception. Doesn't necessarily go into the details of what contributes what, so it's not necessarily helpful for our specific question of how to understand the specifics. And other suggestions throughout the generation of the Sforno and others have been recommended. Throughout the generation, the Sforno has his. We're not going to go into it, but it's on the screen. The Tartamima, as well as Baruch Levi Epstein, more recently, lives from 1860 to 1941. He actually has an idea that harkens back to a lot of philosophy, where he describes another philosophical concept of Hakol Holich Achar Koach Achron, of everything following the final force or the final power. So he says that's why whichever one was the last force or power will be the one that impacts the gender of the child. So if the last force was the zachar, so then that will impact the gender of the child. The child will be a boy, and if the mother's one was later, so then that will be the child will be a girl. Again, interesting theories, and we see that the way that they're grappling with some understanding of philosophy and more so medicine to try and understand exactly what Chazal may or may not be referring to. Tobias Cohn. I mentioned the University of Padua, and I will now continue to share my obsession with the University of Padua. Tobias Cohn lives from 1652 to 1729. He comes from a rabbinic family, and he comes to Padua, which is a town in Italy, which has a, I don't know how prestigious it is today, but throughout history has been a pretty prestigious university, is unique for a lot of their medical advancements, because, like I mentioned, the first place to do use human bodies for medical research and instruction was this University of Padua. They're also incredibly unique by university standards because they let Jews attend the university, which is a historical quirk or anomaly, because you almost never find that. Baruch Hashem, recently, hopefully we don't take for granted the fact that higher education is readily available to the Jewish community, but throughout most of history, higher education in the scholarly and academic world was more or less systematically closed off to the Jewish population. The University of Padua was one of those exceptions, which allowed students to attend, and even more so to attend their medical university was incredibly unique, because it was incredibly hard to get into university, number one, and then even harder for a Jew to get into medical school. So this was very unique. He attends this university, and he publishes a sefer called Maisa Tovia. The sefer Maisa Tovia is not generally quoted, as I'll explain why, in traditional rabbinic texts or for any form of halachic decisions, or for not isn't necessarily of interest to most rabbinic scholars, with the exception of those who are interested in rabbinic and medical history, as I am. So he tries to go through, again, he was a medical doctor, he received his degree from the University of Padua, and he also comes from a rabbinic family. He's well-versed in the rabbinic texts, he's well-versed in the contemporary medical sciences, and he publishes an entire sefer where he tries to account all, as many as he could, statements in Chazal that, based on the contemporary medical practice at that time, didn't seem to align with each other, and he tries to suggest different theories of how they align. So in here, he actually quotes Aristotle in very fascinating and strong terms. He says that he is not happy with Aristotle because he was a kofer and denied the creation ex nihilo and the Metzias HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the reality of HaKadosh Baruch Hu creating the world, and says that he didn't know anything. So he's not happy with Aristotle. And then he quotes William Harvey. And again, of fascinating note is that he quotes William Harvey and actually refers to, you could see it on the very last line, he refers to Ginevarim Vikalim Le Microscope. He refers to the microscope, which was a recent historical development of that time, and says that different things have been observed under the microscope and suggests different theories to try to account for what the contemporary medical practice was, or understanding, and also tries to suggest a theory of how to work that out with the Gemara. All of that, before we get there, all of that is very nice and very important, and very, very important to appreciate and understand the way that both the medical sciences are developing, how the understanding is certainly limited, and throughout time, the science continues to uncover a number of more and more areas that we are able to comprehend and understand, and is able to develop various tools, such as the microscope, to be able to analyze and research and look at what we're dealing with in a more sophisticated and accurate way. So at the end, I'm going to describe what Tobias Cohen was. Wonderful. He did a great thing, and he was a nice doctor and important, he wasn't necessarily a halakhic authority, but at least a halakhic contributor of the time. But I'll describe why the premise of his sefer is not one that resonates with me personally, and will not be the messaging that I want to ultimately contribute today. And with that disclaimer, Dr. Landrum B. Shettles, who lives from 1909 to 2003, he is a fertility doctor, he's an OBGYN, and he does a tremendous amount of research with regards to human reproduction. And one of the things that he finds, we'll read it from this book, The Anatomy of Jewish Law, is a fascinating discovery. Dr. Landrum B. Shettles observes that the Y chromosome travels faster than the X chromosome, so that if a woman ovulates prior to marital relations, there is a greater likelihood that the Y chromosome will reach the egg first, resulting in a male child. This observation led to the reinterpretation of the Talmudic passage. The word mazrat could refer to ovulation, the emission of the female seed, analogous to the emission of male seed. Thus, if a woman emits seed first, she will beget a male child. This reinterpretation of the rabbinic passage was known even to Shettles himself and is found repeatedly in works of Jewish medical ethics. An absolutely fascinating theory and discovery. He publishes a number of papers between, I think, 1960 and 1970. That book that you saw over there with the pretty shocking title that comes out is there, published in 1970, captures public attention. But the medical opinion and scientific community's opinion on this is that his theory is very weak. And subsequent studies and research have not actually confirmed his theory, and therefore it has not been adopted and universally accepted by the medical community. So it's a fascinating theory and would be a fascinating way to think about that line that we said from Chazal. Again, with the disclaimer I just mentioned, I'll describe hopefully at the end why this is definitely a fascinating approach Very interesting thing to think about, but not the ultimate approach that will resonate with me. So that's the first topic. That concludes topic number one. We have two more to go through, and then the messaging. So that's just an overview of what we have left. Fasting on Yom Kippur. So what's the halachic issue of fasting on Yom Kippur, where medical science is important? So make sure everyone's awake. Yeah? We have more coffee? Anyone? Yeah, so fasting on Yom Kippur. Why would we consult the medical field for fasting on Yom Kippur?
Illness,
exactly. Illness. Is that there? Thank you very much. Someone's awake. That if you're fasting on Yom Kippur and there is a medical illness, or let's say a woman is expecting and there is concern for there's a concern for either the mother or the babies, that's the connection to the first topic, and the doctor advises not to fast, so how do we go about making a halachic decision and a medical decision to determine whether or not someone who is not well or someone who is expecting, how do we determine at what point they are not allowed to fast and must break their fast in Yom Kippur? And it's certainly important to note that if one eats on Yom Kippur when they're not supposed to, so that is a chiyuv karis. That's really bad. Excommunication, more than excommunication, that's the complicated to describe exactly what it is, but being cut off in some spiritual method, it's really, really, really bad. It's one of the worst punishments that the Torah gives for anything. It's up there with eating chametz on Pesach. We really don't want to go there. On the other hand, if one is supposed to be eating and they don't, so that's where we get to this line in Shulchan Aruch. Chol eshetzarech lechol. So the Shulchan Aruch, again, the codifier of Jewish law, says that if one who is not well that needs to eat, if there's an expert doctor who is there and says that if we do not feed this individual who is not well, even if the doctor isn't Jewish, we will listen to that doctor, and even if it doesn't necessarily lead to a concern that is life-threatening, but they're not well, fasting will make the illness more severe, and the doctor tells us that. We feed them based on what the doctor's advice is, and afilu amachola omer eini tzarech. Even if the chola says, I'm fine, I don't need it, I will fast on Yom Kippur, shomen l'rofe. You don't listen to the person, but you listen to the doctor. V'machola omer tzarech ani, and what if the chola themselves says, I'm not well, I need to eat, shomen afilu me'arofim omerim eino tzarech, shomem lachola. Even if 100 doctors say that this person is healthy and they don't need to eat, we trust the patient. And the patient who says, I need to eat, we feed that person on Yom Kippur. We let them eat again, even though we said, this is a very serious and high-level transgression. But we will listen to an expert doctor, and we will even listen to the patient to override doctors who say there's no medical reason for this person to eat. We will listen to the patient. The Mishnah Brura, put together by the Chafetz Chaim in more recent times, so he comments on this, that im achola rotza lahachmir, let's say the individual who's not well says, I want to be machmir on myself. I want to be stringent, and I will not listen to the doctors, even though they're telling me to eat. I'm still going to fast on Yom Kippur. He says, in very strong words, that this is a person who his blood is on his own hands. So very serious. We take this incredibly seriously, and you see the rabbinic rhetoric that's being used to describe this is certainly taking into account the combination of how serious Yom Kippur is, while at the same time how serious treating human life is, and ensuring that keeping the laws of fasting on Yom Kippur will not risk anyone's life. What about someone who is expecting? What's the halacha for them? That is right here in Shulchan Aruch, also in Hilchos Yom Kippur. Ubros umenikos misanos umashlimos biyom hakippurim. That women who are expecting or nursing, they fast and they complete their fast on Yom Kippur. Now that might, may or may not come as a surprise in light of what we just said. Obviously, being expecting is a medical scenario, which is obvious, could have complications, could have risks, and so on. And certainly, fasting doesn't seem like a wise or healthy thing to do. Nevertheless, in this context, Ubros uminikos misabros mashlimos, that women who are nursing and who are expecting fast and they complete their fast on Yom Kippur. So that should certainly go with the disclaimer that I didn't put it up here on the slides, but it's a really, really important disclaimer, which is that the first line we read from Shulchan Aruch applies 110% here, meaning that if a doctor does say that this woman should not be fasting, so then of course we listen to the doctor. We would not question that. But if there's no known medical reason or concern for an expecting woman on Yom Kippur, she would still have to fast. This is a picture and a quote from Rav Yisrael Yaakov Fisher, who lives in the old Yishuv in Yerushalayim from 1928 to 2003, some more contemporary times. But he's already there in Jerusalem before the founding of the State of Israel. And he writes a letter of approbation to a sefer called Pnei Baruch on Bikur Cholim, which is a sefer on Hilchos Bikur Cholim, visiting the sick, and a lot of halachos of how to treat the sick, and those who need a refuah shlema. And Rav Yisrael Yaakov Fisher says he likes the book. He thinks it's very good. The author did a good job. But there are a number of points that I disagree on. So attached, please find my 23 points that I disagree with, more or less. And I'm sending you this letter of approbation on condition that you also include all of my 23 disagreements with you in your book. This is one of them. So he refers to, one of the things he quotes is that, is he talks about the details of this halacha of someone who is expecting, what are the details of the halachic parameters of them fasting on Yom Kippur. And Rav Yisrael Yaakov Fisher writes back to him that he says, "Kiyom hazash nechleshu adoros," that in today's times where we see people have become weaker, "v'asros rebos shel nashim mapilos ayadei atanis," and he says that in his calculation, thousands of women have miscarried as a result of fasting on Yom Kippur. "Tzrichin kol hanashim hameubaros ad hachodesh hatshi lechol b'yom kippurim pachos mikashir." Any woman who's expecting, doesn't matter where she's up to in the pregnancy, first trimester, middle trimester, third trimester, doesn't make a difference. They have to eat less than the shear on Yom Kippur. Less than the shear on Yom Kippur is certainly a very important detail that we're not going to describe. But everyone should know, even if you eat a small, very, very tiny amount on Yom Kippur, that's biblically forbidden on Yom Kippur, unless you're supposed to. The first line of defense that we use for someone who's not well is we still try to minimize the amount that they're able to eat, if possible. So we will first, before, again, if they need it to eat normally, we will give them normal food, we'll give them whatever they need, full, you know, drinking, you know, full cup of water, Gatorade, whatever they need, we'll give it to them. But if they will be able to make it through the fast by drinking, you know, let's say just less than a shot glass of water or Gatorade once every 10 minutes, and they'll be able to make it through the fast, so that will be our first line of defense, because that will minimize the severity of the prohibition being violated. But for someone who does not qualify to be taking care of themselves in that way, that is a biblical prohibition and is a very serious violation. So he says, off the cuff, you don't have to consult with the doctors, you don't have to ask the woman if she's feeling okay, if she has any concern, doesn't matter, feed all of them. That's his opinion. Bizman Azan, he claims that in today's generation, you know, at some point, I don't know exactly what year, but some point between 1928 and 2003, he is making the claim that today's generation has become weaker. Might be true, but not in various ways, but not, let's see what other people say about this. This is one of my rabbeim, Rav Yaakov Neuberger, who is a Rosh Yeshiva at YU. He is also the Rav of Beth Abraham, which is a shul in Bergenfield, right next to Teaneck, where I grew up. And he is an expert in pretty much every field of halacha. One of those many is medical halacha. So he, in a shiur that he gave to smicha students on this topic, fasting on Yom Kippur, he quoted from this Rav Fisher that we had on the previous slide, and he pointed out that there are many, many good reasons to strongly disagree with Rav Yisrael Yaakov Fisher's approach. One of them is Rav Yisrael Yaakov Fisher's database. He mentions he lived in the old Yishuv in Yerushalayim prior to the founding of the State of Israel. Now, thank God, today the Jerusalem is built up. There's beautiful infrastructure. There's healthcare. There's running water. There's sanitation. Almost none of that existed prior to contemporary times. The British were actually very helpful in building up a lot of that infrastructure during the British Mandate. But a lot of that didn't exist during a significant portion of Rabbi Yisrael Yaakov Fischer's lifetime. His sample size was the women who were likely malnourished, who likely did not have access to clean water, who likely, if they consulted with either a rabbi or a doctor prior to Yom Kippur, the rabbi and the doctor would say, absolutely, you have to eat because there are risks to this pregnancy. So absolutely, you must eat. So claims of Virberger, Rav Fischer's database was significantly limited, and therefore the conclusion he led to has not been accepted pretty much by the normative halachic opinion. Rav Fischer's opinion has not been accepted. And what Rav Neuberger recommends is a lot more similar to over here. This is Rabbi Dr. Yosef Cohen. Do we know him? Yeah? Yeah. A couple years older than me, I guess, but somewhere between me and Hanan's age, around there. And he is, again, received smicha from Reitz and is a medical, is an Einstein, I think? And okay, fine. So, but he's in medical school. Toward the end of medical school, he focuses mostly on medical research, is what he spends most of his time doing. He's also a rabbi of a shul in Yonkers, I think, somewhere in the New York area. So he is a fascinating guy. He gave a talk to Reed students, What Every Rabbi Should Know About Medical Research. That was the title of his presentation. And he was very, very kind to allow me to plagiarize directly from that presentation. And here's some of the points that he points out. So knowing what to ask is a very, very important factor when it comes to approaching a medical and halachic issue. So for example, he says, ask a physician, if a pregnant woman fasts, will there be no danger? He says, that's a bad question to ask. Will there be no danger? He says, that's impossible to answer. Because especially in the medical field, there will always be some danger. So he notes that one should be wary of physicians that speak in absolutes. So if you, often around 20 years ago, something changed in the medical field that a lot of women, especially expecting women, would come to their rabbis and say, my doctor told me I'm not allowed to fast. And the rabbi says, okay, so then you should eat. But then more women started saying this, and more women started saying this, and every single woman who was expecting was being advised by their doctor not to fast. So rabbis became curious. So rabbis did their research. They went to the doctors and asked, used some of this advice to ask the questions to the doctors in a smart way. They asked the doctors like this: is there any special risk to this individual pregnancy that concerns you? The doctor would say no. Is there anything in this woman's medical history that indicates that there is a reason for concern? Any history of dehydration, any past surgeries, any past medical procedures that concern you that are indicating to you that you should advise this woman not to fast? He says no. Will you ever let any of your women, patients, would you let any of them fast? Absolutely not, not one of them. At that point, so now we become skeptical of the medical opinion. For these purposes, because if there's no specific reason of concern in this specific pregnancy, so then from a halachic perspective, this woman still has to fast. If there's any reason for concern for this specific pregnancy, or this woman, or her medical history, so then, of course, we would allow her to fast. I should note, dehydration is sakanas nefashos. It is life-threatening, and that's really the primary concern, especially for expecting women around Yom Kippur and for the general population. Most individuals who have a medical issue with fasting on Yom Kippur is a result of dehydration. So it's very important for both rabbis and doctors to educate the broader community, especially prior to Yom Kippur, but any fast that people will be fasting, to know and recognize the signs of dehydration, including lightheadedness, including some other things that, again, I mentioned, I'm not a medical doctor, so don't actually trust me on this. But again, there are a number of signs and symptoms of dehydration, and it is life-threatening. And if one is ever in that situation, consult a doctor or a medical care immediately to make sure that one will be okay. But that's the main concern when one is not eating and drinking. An important note to put in here as well is that around 20 years ago, any legal historians in the room? No? No legal historian? Okay. Any lawyer? No lawyer in a shul? Oh, okay. But in any case, I think it was around 20 years ago. I didn't look this up. I should look this up. But around 20 years ago, I think the popularity of suing people became, especially in the medical field, became a popular thing for people to do. So anytime someone was upset at their doctor, anytime they were concerned that something, you know, the doctor mistreated them, they would run to a lawyer and try to make a lot of money off of a lawsuit. No doctor, again, beware of people who speak in absolutes. As far as I'm aware, no doctor, if any, has been sued for advising a woman to act in a healthy way and eat and drink on a fast day. No doctor has ever been sued for that. So doctors, again, not necessarily from a medical opinion, but from a personal protective opinion of their own practice, reputation, and their license, and again, saving them from a lawsuit, there's no motivation for them to tell people that you should, yeah, sure, you should fast, because that's not a smart thing for a medical doctor to do. So that became popular around 20 years ago, and that's when all these patients would be hearing this advice from their doctors, would now come to their rabbis and say, what am I supposed to do? I'm not, the doctor told me I'm not allowed to fast. What could I do about this? And it's a fascinating phenomenon, I think, that more recently, Rav Neuberger actually lamented about this, that when you go to the older generation and you tell them that they have to eat on Yom Kippur, so it's devastating to them. It's devastating to them, and they'll fight you about it, and they'll say, no, to eat on Yom Kippur, are you crazy? And the older generation will fight you on it, and it doesn't matter what, even if the doctor told them, you have to convince them. And part of the job of a Rav is actually to convince and comfort people who do have to eat on Yom Kippur and convince them that this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from them, that Hashem wants them to eat, that every other year of their life they're supposed to fast because of their medical condition. They have to eat, and you have to encourage them to do so. In more recent generations, people's approach to Yom Kippur, unfortunately, I think, has become dampened. It's a shame. It should be strengthened. That people's approach to Yom Kippur is, okay, so the doctor told me that I'm supposed to eat, so I'll eat. And then they're not necessarily as bothered as people, naturally from an older generation, were naturally so shocked and bothered that it wouldn't even cross their mind that someone would ever eat on Yom Kippur. So that's just something to note. That is that more or less concludes any questions before we go on about fasting on Yom Kippur. Okay, we have a few minutes left. Let's talk about everyone's favorite topic. Mitzitza bepeh, bris milah. Got some bagels on the, it's not bad. All right, so Mitzitza bepeh is described in the Mishnah and Shabbos. Mitzitza bepeh will translate as oral suctioning. The Mishnah says, Osin kol tzarchei milah b'Shabbos. One fulfills all of the needs of a circumcision on Shabbos. Malin, uporin, umotzitzin. You do the milah, you pull back. And one does oral suctioning. V'nosnin ala ispalnis v'kamon. And one also puts on a bandage and some ointment that will assist in the healing of the wound. The Gemara, the Rashi says, motzin as hadam. What is this to orally suction the blood? And even though that makes a chabura, that makes a wound. By suctioning blood, that makes a wound. And that is normally forbidden to do on Shabbos. One still does this on Shabbos because it's part of the circumcision process. The Gemara on Kuflam and Gimel Mabez says Motzitzin. So Amarav Papa that Hai Umna de Lo Mayitz, that if one encounters a Moel who does circumcision but does not suction the blood, Sakanahu Vavrinan Lei, it is dangerous and you remove them from their post. Says the Gemara, is not obvious, you violate Shabbos for this. And the Gemara continues to describe exactly why that needed to be taught to us. And the conclusion is that it is a danger to not do bris milah, to not do mitzitza bepeh, to not suction the blood from the wound, it will be dangerous to the child to not perform that part of the circumcision. The Rambam even adds that one is meant to take blood from mekamos rechokim, from far away places. And here we go, mitzitza bepeh. The articles start coming out. Mitzitza bepeh, controversy, rabbinic polemics, and applying the lessons of history is an article published in Jewish World, or Jewish Action, in the winter of 2006. It reads as follows. Some time ago, a series of babies became infected with serious life-threatening sores in the groin areas shortly after they were circumcised. It was alleged both by physicians and by some local rabbis that the sores were the result of them all performing mitzitza bepeh, the ancient tradition of orally suctioning the wound after incision. The mall was alleged may have had a communicable disease and passed it on to the children, who because of their undeveloped immune systems were more susceptible to the severe effects of this disease. As a result, some doctors condemned the practice of mitzitza bepeh and sought government involvement to ban or at least to regulate the practice. Some rabbis in the community reacted by defending the practice and argued that A, this was a religious rite and therefore not within the purview of the medical community. B, that there was no conclusive proof that the children had been infected by their moel. And C, under no circumstances could a religious Jew deviate from this age-old tradition of mitzitza bepeh. All these details may sound familiar because they have appeared in one form or another recently in our media, but the above is not a depiction of recent events. All this occurred in the 1830s. So this is a pretty old debate. This is about a 200-year-old debate that the medical field has discovered this practice and started criticizing Jewish people for doing this, and rabbis had to sort of try to accommodate for what the medical opinion was and to figure out some way to accommodate for what the medical opinion is, coupled with the age-old practice of mitzitza bepeh. A very shocking title over here is from the NIH, Ultra-Orthodox Jews Criticized Over Circumcision Practice. That's a little, strong and jarring. So what were people saying about this? The Rabbi Yisrael Lipschitz already comments in this in his commentary on Mishnayos. He lives in Germany from 1782 to 1860, so probably at the height of his rabbinic career, this debate surfaced and the controversy begins. And he refers to the fact that maybe we should be listening to the doctors. The doctors are indicating that this might actually be dangerous now. We mentioned that it's dangerous to not do it. Maybe now it's dangerous to yes do it. So maybe we should stop doing it. Says the Tiferes Yisrael, nope, it doesn't matter. V'afal pikein nira li, libli lozos midivrei chazal. That we cannot move from that which the sages have set out for us. And if this is part of our tradition, it's part of our halachos, we cannot move from them. And we have to do that, even though the doctors say this. Then he backs off a little bit. He says maybe Shabbos, you shouldn't do it with full force. So maybe you shouldn't do it quite as much as you would do it during the weekday. But again, he's sort of towing this line, but comes out on the side very strongly to, yes, still be doing mitzitza bepeh. Similarly, Rav Avram Bornstein, the son of the Sfas Emes, I believe, and the son-in-law of the Kotzker Rebbe. He himself is a Hasidish Rebbe as well, but is also a very, very significant halachic authority. He writes Shilos Tshuvos titled Avnei Nezer, and which are quoted very frequently in the halachic rabbinic discourse. And he is presented with Shilah. Mitzitza bepeh, doctors nowadays, again, he lives from 1838 to 1910, so he's living through this controversy. He says that mitzitza, do we still have to do it? His conclusion is, yes, he adds an important point, that when Chazal said that it was because of danger, so who says they were only talking about a physical danger? Maybe they were also referring to some spiritual danger, that perhaps there's a spiritual danger that one is removing by doing mitzitza bepeh. He doesn't necessarily explain exactly why the mitzitza was. He refers to some Kabbalistic sources that, again, if you understand them, may or may not explain what they were, what the spiritual danger is that he's referring to. But he says that one still has to do mitzitza bepeh, even in light of the medical authorities that are being discussed. Rav Yaakov Ellinger is the Rebbe of Rav Shamshenfall Hirsch in Germany from 1798 to 1871. And he writes in Altoona. Altoona is one of the towns there in Germany. He addresses the Shiloh in a very similar way, very similar to Avnei Nezer. He discusses the fact that it's long tshuva, we're not going to read it, but just comes to the same conclusion that the doctors have made this case. He actually questions the connection between the Moel and the child? Was the Moel actually responsible for the disease that was generated in the child? He questions that assertion and comes to the conclusion that we still have to account for this practice. We still have to do it, even in light of any medical the medical opinion that is being currently being shared. Now come to 2005, so more recently, there was a couple of famous or infamous cases that caught the media's attention and the New York City Department of Health's attention, and they published an open letter to the community in December of 2005, which with pretty strong and convicting languages, and they said, let me just find the line, the health department, where is it? Let me see. Language like this: the health department recommends that infants being circumcised not undergo metzitza bepeh. To help protect their baby, parents should understand the risk of metzitza bepeh before the day of the bris, while there is time to explore other options. The department has reviewed all the evidence, and there exists no reasonable doubt that metzitza bepeh can and has caused neonatal herpes infection. We have always maintained that it is our preference for religious community to address these issues itself, as long as the public's health is protected. While some medical professionals and others in the Jewish community have called the department to completely ban metzitza bepeh at this time, it is our opinion that educating the community through public health information and warnings is a more realistic approach. Here are a few more articles. New York Jewish leaders reach a deal on circumcision health. This becomes a big debate. When I Googled metzitza bepeh, the New York City Health Department has a whole webpage dedicated to this information, and available are two flyers to print out in your shul in English and Yiddish. For whatever language is popular in your shul, you could, here in St. Louis, I obviously would go with the Yiddish one, and you could put it up that you have have a safe bris for your baby, and, you know, again, public education to educate the community of the, as they said, fully convicting evidence that exists that disease has been linked. So how did the Jewish community respond to this? Coming into the close, we have Rav Tendler and Bris Social Avram, okay, on the two extremes, and then we'll come to a middle approach. Rav Tendler is the first one, and he says that based on contemporary medical opinion, no longer do metzitza bepeh. He even takes it to an extreme and says that a moel that does metzitza bepeh on Shabbos violated Shabbos and has to separate a karban chatas for when the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt, because he's going to have to bring a sin offering for what he did. Rav Tendler, rest in peace, he passed away a few years ago, held no punches. Okay, when he had an opinion, held no punches, held no prisoner. He said it with as much strength as he possibly could. On the other hand, we have the Bris Social Avram, which is just one of many Svarim and articles and Pashkvilin, which are, you know, big kolkores that, you know, people paste on the walls and shuls or whatever, saying that people are bad and so on, other things. But basically, they it's a whole category, but this is representative. He says one should not listen to the medical community who is trying to put in pechadim, mezuyach bilibeno, these false, fabricated fears that they are trying to instill in our hearts, and I'm being dramatic just because he's dramatic, but these false fears that they are putting into our hearts, we cannot listen to them, and don't move from our angel practice. Still have to do metzitza bepeh. No questions asked. Now, here's the middle approach. Dr. Berman is the father of Rue Berman and Aaron Berman, who are my friends. And they are a few years older than me, and you guys probably know them as well, that they're a few years older than me in NYU. Their father is an immunologist who also works together with the New York State Department of Health. When this controversy began, he was very upset by some of the lobbying that was going on and was taking place, very, very bothered by the broader community's polemics that were occurring, the way the media tagged onto this and popularized this issue in we mentioned, you know, different articles that have been published. And he dives into the research and dives into the literature that's out there to actually figure out what is what's going on. And he publishes a few of his research. One of the articles is up here in the letter to the editor. Another one is Mitzitza B'Peh dangerous? And his conclusion is that the evidence is very, very small and very weak to link up the cases of Mitzitza B'Peh to any of the infections that have developed in children as a result of the circumcision. And that is his conclusion, is that he actually has fascinating statistics where he describes the fact that it is more dangerous to ride a bike than to have Mitzitza B'Peh. And that more children a year go through his emergency room, or more children who go through his emergency room and the medical system in general from biking accidents than they do from Mitzitza B'Peh. The way I humorously want to say it is that there's a higher chance of a baby being dropped by the kvater as he walks into the bris milah than being infected by Mitzitza B'Peh. But Rav Neuberger is what I mentioned in the middle approach. I apologize that I'm over time. I could stop, or we could just go for three more minutes. That's okay with everyone? I mentioned to someone that if you want to be invited back, so you try to end on time, but well, three more minutes. Rav Neuberger says it's a balancing act because Rav Hirsch, I have a copy of his tshuva, Rav Hirsch, who is the Talmud of Rav Yaakov Anlinger, lived during the time that a tube, Mitzitza tube, was developed, which prevents oral contact between the mole's mouth and the mila. So that's a great option because you're still able to do Mitzitza B'Peh. You're just doing it bikli. You're doing it with a tube instead of having having a direct contact. Rav Neuberger says, so it's a balancing act. How seriously do we treat Mitzitza B'Peh? And how seriously do we treat the medical opinion? And do we have a viable alternative? And we do. So therefore, the majority practice, at least I think within our community, someone could confirm what happens here in St. Louis, but I'm pretty confident that for my son, for my son's bris, which happened about 8 months ago, where the picture was, I'm pretty sure a tube was used. We'll do this pretty quickly just to get a little bit of an overview, and we'll read from Rabbi Dr. Reichman's book, who says this in a beautiful way, in terms of the development between the medical system and science and the development of the halachic system and the Torah that we've been given, the Torah we're so excited to receive once more in just a short time on Shavuos. Let's just wait 2 minutes, and then I'll be happy to take the questions after. He says that while throughout the ages we have been blessed with Torah sages who have been the repositories of all extant Torah knowledge, no such analogy exists in science. There is no human being who possesses all knowledge of medicine and science. The greatest minds in the history of medicine and science knew only the minutiae of their specific fields. Einstein knew very little about human physiology. Science, by definition, is a collaborative endeavor, advanced only through the accumulated efforts of thousands of great minds across the span of time. And what the main point that he makes is similar to the way that Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks does in his book, The Great Partnership, Religion versus Science, and he talks about the Great Partnership, and this is just a beautiful quote. Science takes things apart to show how they work. Religion puts things together to see what they mean. In the context of this study and of this presentation, I think we could go a step further, and we could also take religion apart, we could take the halachic system apart to give a greater and more thorough appreciation of how the halachic system works, but also put science together to actually get a broader understanding of how science works and what it actually means. Someone who actually goes through that very well, I have an essay over here published by a contemporary philosopher, Thomas Kuhn, who talks about the structure of scientific revolutions. These are some of the books that have been published in response to that whole debate. But Taras Hashem Tamima, the main messaging that I want to communicate is that Taras Hashem Tamima, on some level, on the essential level, Torah is full. It is complete. Istako baba reiso bara alma, a famous line from the Zohar that HaKadosh Baruch Hu looked into the Torah in order to create the world. The Mishnah Navos that says, hafachba vafachba dekula ba, that in just look through the Torah and continue to seek within it and draw everything out from it, because everything is within it. And we pray and daven for the day of Lo Yirvu Lo Yashkisu B'chol Har Kodeshi for this line, Ki Malah Ha'aretz, not just of Torah Mada that Yeshiva University promotes, but Ki Malah Ha'aretz De'as Hashem, of a true and full and complete knowledge of Hashem. Thank you very much for joining. This has been an absolute pleasure to learn together and to spend the Shabbos and the weekend here together. I hope you enjoyed even a fraction of as much as I enjoyed, because I enjoyed tremendously. Thank you very much. And again, like I said, when one departs from their friends, so one should depart with words of Torah, and thereby the conversation and the relationship does not end, but we'll be able to continue. This is the way to reach me. Looking forward to future opportunities to connect and learn together. Wishing everyone a wonderful day, a wonderful week, and a good Yom Tov for Shavuos Kabbalas HaTorah.